Job chapter 3. After this, Job opened his mouth, and Job spake and said, Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, There is a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness, let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it, let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. Let them curse it that curse the day, who are ready to raise up their mourning. Let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me, or why the breast that I should suck? For now should I have lain still, and being quiet. I should have slept, and then had I been at rest, with kings and counselors of the earth, which built desolate or ruined places for themselves, or with princes that had gold, who filled their houses with silver, or as an untimely birth, I had not been, as infants which never saw light, stillborn children. There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. There the prisoners rest together, they hear not the voice of the oppressor. The small and great are there, and the servant is free from his master. Wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul, which long for death, but it cometh not, and dig for it more than for hid treasures, which rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid and whom God hath hedged in? For my sighing cometh before I eat, and my roarings are poured out like the waters. For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. And now, after the long silence of chapter 2 and verse 13, so they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. After 7 days and 7 nights of utter silence, the silence is broken by Job. After this, after 7 days and 7 nights of silence, opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. From verse 3 to verse 10, as you'll see in your notes, Job is cursing the day he was born. Job curses the day he was born. Now, there is one very important respect in which Job's speeches differ from those of his friends that we'll be studying throughout coming weeks. And it is very important that we see where this difference is. These fellows talk to Job about God. And Job too talks about God. But Job's utterance is in an entirely different direction than theirs. Job is not arguing a point. He's trying to understand his experience. He openly talks to himself. He's struggling in his own mind. He's trying to retain or to recover what he feels is a lost friendship with God. He feels he has lost God. Do you ever feel like that? I do sometimes. You see, you and I in our everyday life, we love the Lord, many of us here tonight. And we know God through everyday circumstances, our families, our homes, our friends. But when all our friends disappear, and when our families are in trouble, and money goes and flees and takes wings, and trouble hits us, all the familiar things that we knew God through are taken away from us, and we lose our equilibrium and our balance. And we feel we have lost God altogether. Ever feel like that? Millions do. Millions of Christians at times feel like that. And the devil loves them to feel like that. And he's appealing to God again and again and again in his speeches. And his prayers may shock you and the evangelical world. Why is it we hear so little of them? And his prayers may shock his religious friends. But at least he has one great quality. Through all of his troubles, he keeps talking to God. You and I must do that whenever at times we face utter despair. And I don't care who you are, there'll be times in your life when you come to utter despair. Keep talking to God. Like Mr. Buckley said one evening here on Thursday evening, praise the Lord, even whether you feel like it or not. His friends talk about God, but Job talks to God. That's a lovely difference. Many people talk to me about God, but a young evangelist on the phone this morning, he said, we'll pray. And over the phone, he talked to God about me. That was an interesting experience. How refreshing are those kind of people who not only talk about God, but who talk to God. I love Billy Graham's quote, and God bless him. He's preaching in the Winter Gardens in Blackpool tonight. May he see many souls won for Christ. I love what Billy said at the time when this theory was going across the world that God was dead. And the reporters came in from the newspapers and sat down beside the evangelist and said, what do you think about the God is dead movement? And Billy said, well, if he's dead, he can't be dead very long because I was talking to him this morning. Keep talking to God. That's what Job does. I love that. Someone has said this makes him the only authentic theologian in the book. And God's eventual endorsement of Job's stand doesn't mean to say that God agrees with every theological statement that Job made or that it's correct. We're not saying that every theological comment he made is correct or even that all his friends said was wrong. But God eventually does endorse him, even from the beginning and all the way through. And some of Job's prayers are wild. That's about the best word I could find for them. And they must have seemed very dangerous to his very dignified friends. And his audacious attempts to reach the mind of God leave us breathless. He's desperately trying to get through to God. And they must have worried his rather cautious friends. He's passionate. But they're cold. Job is dreadfully in earnest and transparently honest and tells God exactly what he thinks and tells God how he feels. And there can be hardly anything wrong with prayers that do that. Someone said about a man's prayer, they said that fellow praying, it was the best prayer ever delivered to an American audience. But prayers aren't to be delivered to audiences. They're to be delivered to God. And please remember that when you're praying. Some people, when they pray, are like a record. You could tell exactly what they're going to say and the very patterns that they have. But our friend Job cut up a different road. He told God how he felt. He told God what he thought. He poured it all out to the Lord. There's a lovely songwriter here tonight, and I'm going to let you hear them sing in the first 15 minutes of Tuesday night at the Crescent from about 7:45 until 8 o'clock on the 16th of March. And you're going to hear some of Janice's lovely songs, because I think she's one of the most gifted songwriters we have in Ulster at the moment. She'd be embarrassed to hear me say that, but I feel that. And a whole crowd of the group that they sing with from the YM were up in my house on Sunday night, and they were singing to my children. And I even got them out of bed to let them hear it. It was just beautiful. And you know, one of Janice's lovely songs just makes this very point. And I was listening carefully to the words, how in one of her songs she says how she tells the Lord everything. If you were in my study in the morning, beside me, as we're preparing for these meetings, you would wonder what on earth goes on as I talk to the Lord. I lost something. I'm always losing things. And my wife's always finding them. My, she's fantastic at that. It's a gift with her. She's got eagle eyes. She must have. She took me, but there it is. And you know, I go around and sometimes I lose things. And if Margaret's not at hand, I say, Lord, I desperately need that, and I don't know where it is in this library of mine. Because the right hand of my library doesn't know what my left hand of my library doeth. I said, Lord, I can't find it. Would you help me to find it? And just like a flash, it's over there. I went and looked. There it was. I talked to God about things like that. Talked to God about how I feel. I'm feeling down this morning, Lord. Not feeling I'm getting freedom. Feel I'm out of touch with you, Lord. Is there something wrong? What about this and what about that and what about the other? Talking to God about the nitty-gritty of everyday life. Pouring out before the Lord everything. You can't always pour out in public everything. I remember praying once in a prayer meeting. My wife was expecting the twins at the time. And I was really going through it. And I remember praying about it. And the fellow went home and he said, I didn't go to that prayer meeting to hear Derek Bingham praying about his domestic matters. Some people don't take too kindly if you ask the Lord to remember your pregnant wife. They think that's too close to the nitty-gritty. They want the nice phraseology and the generalities. And they don't want fellows to get up and pour out their hearts before the Lord about the problems they have. And because I sometimes am aware of that, you have to be careful how you pray. I know that you can't say everything. Although, mind you, if your wife is pregnant, brother, you'll need to pray. So don't you keep at it. And the Lord will hear your prayers. But I believe that so much of our prayer life and our public prayer life is so stagnant. There's no life in it. It's so dead. It's just phraseology. Just going around the world and back home by the south of Ireland. Around all the mission field. Bless all the missionaries, Lord. And they start to go around and they always come back through Dublin or wherever. And you can work it out. And why are our prayer meetings empty? I sometimes wonder, is it because we're scared to pray? We're scared to pour out our hearts before the Lord. Scared to come before the Lord and tell Him how we feel. And how our mind is. And what we need. And maybe if we had a bit more honest prayer, then prayer meetings would be less stagnated. We're praying to our brethren instead of praying to the Lord. Why has God put on record these cries of this man? Does God spare us the utter despair of this man, the most perfect man? In all of the East and in all of the world, God said about this man, there is none like him. That's not what I said, that's what God said. And yet God puts down in plain print for 20th century people to read his prayers and his feelings. I think there's a lesson in that. Let's start telling the Lord how we feel. Let's start pouring out our needs before Him. And then prayer will really become something. Think of that lovely Savior who held the world in His hand while Mary held up Him. Who had more power than we'll ever know what power is. Lay prostrate in prayer in the garden and sweat, as it were, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Listen to Him pray. Listen to Him pray. My friend Alan Redpath was asked by A.W. Tozer to join him in Chicago in his early morning prayer meetings. As he rose at 5 a.m. and lay on the shores of Lake Michigan with his face in the sand often, morning after morning, crying to God about the needs of the students he preached to in the great city of Chicago. Morning after morning, as Tozer rose, and Alan Redpath said, I just couldn't join him. It was too sacred. He said it was too sacred. It was Tozer and God. Wonder how many preachers in this city are lying with their faces in the grass at 5 a.m. about the needs of this place. Not that you have to be up at 5 a.m, but is it any wonder that Tozer is selling now as much as ever he did his written works for the Lord, and his ministry has a power in it that makes some of us feel like little boys. These men were men of prayer. These men had power, spiritual power, because they knew what it was to talk with God. Do you know what it is, Christian, to talk with God? Or are you afraid to tell Him everything? I love the Queen of Sheba coming to Solomon with her hard questions. And as she comes with her hard questions, she pours them all out. And Solomon answers them. She was able to tell him, says the Bible. She told him everything that was in her heart. Isn't that a beautiful expression? She sat down with him and told him everything that was in her heart. I have a friend here this evening who is a pastor to my soul. And I'll be at his house after this meeting is over, pouring out to him everything that is in my heart about the burdens of this ministry. Why? Because he pastors me. And he's sympathetic. And he lets me pour it all out. And after I have it all poured out, then maybe he'll pray with me or give me a word. And he'll never know. £1 million couldn't pay him for the balm in Gilead that he is to me in these difficult days. It's good to have a friend in life you can pour everything out to, and you're not afraid. You're not afraid he'll tell it on you. Not afraid he'll walk over it with his big boots or small boots. Not afraid. Very few you can trust like that, but you can trust your Lord. If the Queen of Sheba could tell Solomon everything that was in her heart, a greater than Solomon is here. His name is Jesus. And you can tell Him everything that is in your heart. Pour it all out. Your doubts, your fears, your worries, your problems. Casting all your care upon Him. For He careth for you. Have we got beyond Frank Knox's little statement that he used to preach around this country? A little talk with Jesus. How it smooths the rugged road. A little talk with Jesus. And sometimes the prayers may seem wild, and others would criticize them severely if they were said in public. And people have been very hard on old Job for what he said in this chapter. But there's another point that we must make. Another general feature of Job's speeches that I could not emphasize too strongly in this service this evening. There are scholars who find his volcanic outbursts in this dialogue with his three friends utterly different from the tranquility of the prologue that I've spent the last few weeks on. And they say he's a different man in chapter 3 than he was in chapters 1 and 2. But they overlook the fact that nowhere does Job bewail the loss of his animals, or the loss of his children or his home. Nowhere is Job bewailing his illness in this sense. In this, he's utterly consistent. This isn't his cry. He's not starting out to bewail this. His concern from the beginning to the end is God. Not his health or his wealth, but his life with God. Is that your primary concern this evening? And is that mine? My life with God? That's what he's about. Because he seems to have lost God, that he's in such a torment. And you can see the relationship with God that he has known in other things has now been taken away from him. And when he's lost everything, he seems to have lost God. And this is his concern. He wants to get closer to God. And you know, in this first speech of Job, the spectacle of human misery is presented with a poignancy that quite overwhelmed me. I tell you, I've had an interesting 2 days with this chapter. It's about the most depressing stuff you could ever read in your life. It's about the lowest that a human mind can get to in depression. But it's in the Bible, and I can't say we'll skip it. I know I'll be criticized by some who'll say, terribly sorrowful stuff that, but I've got to face it. What is it there for? What does it mean? Why was it written? What has it to say to us? Well, 5 times in this speech of this chapter, Job asks the question, why? And even the best answers of his friends couldn't satisfy that simple question. Why? And Job opened his mouth and cursed his day. And it's important, please, to note in this first verse and all the way through that Job did not curse God. He does not question God. He doesn't even reproach God. He's not even curious at this point to find out why the undeserving suffer. But he's talking about how wretched human existence can be. In fact, he gets to the point in this verse where he wishes he'd never been born at all. Best never to have been born at all. Now, what does it mean after this? Job opened his mouth, verse 1, and cursed his day. What does to curse mean? Well, in Hebrew, it's entirely different to our word curse. In Hebrew, or amongst the Hebrews, the Jewish people, and in Hebrew, it is the very opposite of the word to bless. You bless something, the very opposite of that is to curse it. It is to wish a catastrophe on it, to execrate it. And the modern Western practice of cursing, that is using profane language, is never referred to in the scriptures. It cannot be emphasized too strongly that the startling sentiments expressed in these 26 verses do not mean that Job had cracked under the strain and that the devil says, well, there you are. He has cursed God. There is no hint that Satan has finally made his point. And anyway, as Anderson points out in his brilliant commentary on this passage, self-control is something quite different from not showing your emotions. I want to stay with this for a minute. Job sure shows his emotion in these 26 verses, as you will see. Well, does that mean he's lost self-control? The Bible is not trying to present to Christian people the religion of the Stoics. Job was no Stoic. You know what the Stoics believe? Following Stoa. Noble enough, but heathen in its origin. The Stoics, they try to be pure mind and no feeling. So whenever trouble hits you, it's all You let it all be in your mind. You don't show any feeling. The Bible doesn't know anything of that kind of dehumanizing philosophy. And you know, we stand in a long tradition in the Western Church of a pallid kind of piety that has confused the Christian way with the heathen ethic of the Stoics. In Galatians 5 and 23, we are told that one of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. And in 1 Corinthians 9 and 25, you find that that self-control is used by Paul in a beautiful, beautiful teaching. Let's look at it. 1 Corinthians 9 and 25. This is a very important point, helping us to understand this chapter. First Corinthians 9 and 24. Know ye not that they which run in a race, verse 24, 1 Corinthians 9, run all, but one receiveth the prize. So run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep my body under, self-control, and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. Here is a beautiful explanation of the Christian truth of self-control. Here's an athlete, and he does without his cigarettes. And he does without his beer. And he does without his late nights. And he only eats certain food. And he is temperate. He is temperate, verse 25, in all things. Because he's striving for the mastery. And watch Zeb Coe as he comes around in what, the 1400 meters in Moscow. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. And the commentator screaming, "Where is the Coe kick?" What a line that was. I wondered what he meant. I thought he was being a bit hard on old Zeb. As if it wasn't going to come. But I'll never forget that fellow streaking. Better watch that word. Streaking for the line. And as he comes round that bend, I almost felt how to find words. The cold kick, my goodness. His muscles seemed to be elastic. That man who had for years trained now strives for the mastery and wins. That's the image. And so Paul's saying, I'm going in for spiritual things. And as I go in for spiritual things, I too have to have self-control. I have to do without certain things. It is the self-mastery that releases the energies of an athlete into a superb performance. Now going back to Job 3. Please remember this, friends. That as you and I talk about self-control in a Christian context, don't let us take this self-control and wither it into a purely negative suppression of desire. It's a far more healthy thing than that. You do without in order that you might win. And certain things are legitimate to other people that aren't legitimate to me for the cause of Christ. And I have to do without. And there are some people around, you know, and they would take this ethic of self-control to such an extent that even sex is considered out. And sexual continence becomes a great virtue. The Bible doesn't know anything of that. The Bible has its clear laws about sexuality and its sacredness. It wasn't brought from Hollywood. It was brought by God. And some of these Bible teachers in the past have taken this idea of self-control to such an extent that they wouldn't even allow you to have a feeling. and look with such disapproval on the weakling majority who cannot walk calmly in the furnace of life and its problems undisturbed. You and I can't walk undisturbed, can we? The Bible's not teaching that we should be undisturbed. This tradition, I can tell you, that cuts away even feeling that God has given, natural healthy feeling, an expression of feeling that cuts it away, doesn't take Job as his patron saint. They find James's reference to our friend Job and his patience. You know how James talks of Job and his patience. They find it incredible that James would even think of calling Job patient. And the overmastering sorrow of this third chapter and his outbursts as being entirely unscriptural. But Job is a man bereaved. And his nerves are on fire. And his skin is festering, as we saw last week. And as Job 6 and 12 says, he's not a man of stone or bronze. Because if he were, then he would have no feeling. He might remain unmoved if he were bronze or stone. And please remember this statement. The Lord's testing of Job is not to find out if Job can sit unmoved like a piece of wood. And the deep hold at this kind of, well, the English call it the stiff upper lip in the face of tragedy, has taken hold of the Anglo-Saxon standards of propriety, especially men. They're not allowed to show feeling. When the men cry, they're supposed to be weaklings. I remember one night a pack of boys got onto me and they tore me apart with their tongues. And I broke down and I cried. It was in the Lord's work. I'll never forget it. I can see them around me like baying wolves. And I cried. And a friend of mine sitting beside me, a godly fellow, I said, "I'm sorry I cried, brother, when I went outside." He said, "Derek, you were never stronger in all your life than when you cried." I'll never forget him for saying that. The Stoics would have you a stiff upper lip as the critics come bombing in over the top of you and tear you apart. Not understanding your motivation, perhaps, or misunderstanding you. They would have you that you would never shed a tear, and if you don't shed a tear, how strong he is. How godly he is. He doesn't even cry. Maybe if I cried a bit more often, people would see into the heart of God's work and understand that we men who stand here ministering aren't supermen. We're just the same as you are. Just exactly the same with the same problems. This can be traced back to Cicero and Cicero's writings influencing the Renaissance. And the Renaissance brought it into Europe. This Anglo-Saxon thing where no feeling in the face of tragedy is godly. Job doesn't know anything about that. And you'll notice how the press in our day, the press today, continues to applaud public figures who are stoic in bereavement. I know a friend in this land who lost his wife. And he was so beside himself with sorrow, he locked himself in a room for 2 days. And I heard him torn apart by others. Ah, how little they understand. Job's friends showed a very limited capacity to weep with those who weep. Paul tells you to do that in Romans 12. And a whole lot of us show our embarrassment in the presence of people who are mourning. And our embarrassment betrays a similar failure in us all too often, all too often, to be able to openly sit down with people and weep with them. Weep with those who weep. And if you're standing where grief is and you feel the tears coming, let them flow, brother. Jesus wept. No stoic. No, the Son of God. Not an unfeeling, stiff upper lip Anglo-Saxon. No, the Son of God. God revealed in flesh, standing by the graveside of that beloved Lazarus, crying. And I haven't got a high priest at God's right hand at the moment who can't be touched with the feelings of my infirmities. Because he was tested and tried in all points and tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Oh, friends, this evening, we have a Christ who understands. Maybe the Negroes say it the best. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows but Jesus. Interesting points. And I think Jesus' tears help us to understand this chapter. He cursed his day. It seems to me that when he beheld those two fellows sitting beside him for 7 days and seven nights, the mere spectacle of their faces as they looked on Job and didn't even recognize him because of all his illnesses, that the sense of his misery hits him even closer when these fellows are sitting around him. And over those 7 days and seven nights, it gathers a new force and he sees his trouble reflected in their eyes. And he opens his mouth in verse 2 of Job 3, and Job spake and said, "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it is said, there is a man-child conceived." He curses the night of his conception on the day of his birth. He wishes a catastrophe would fall on it. He does anything but bless it. And then more particularly, in verses 4 and 5, "Let that day be darkness, and let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it, and let darkness and the shadow of death stain it, let a cloud dwell upon it, and let the blackness of the day terrify it." He now gets more particular in his detail, and he prays that the day of his birth may be as dark as night. Forgotten by God. Let God forget that I was even born. Don't let the day of my birth, let it be unillumined by the sun. Let it be, as it were, reclaimed by death. Death is the proper possession of my day of birth. Let it be lost in clouds. Let it be exposed to all the terrors that are incident and possible to any day of life. Let every terror known to man fall upon the day of my birth. That's how he feels, and he says it. And with equal ingenuity and precision, he curses the night of his conception. In verse 6, "As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come unto the number of the months. Lo, let that night be solitary, and let no joyful voice come therein. And let them curse it that curse the day, who are ready to raise up their mourning. And let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day." He's saying, may the primal darkness seize upon it and swallow it up, so that it shall be blotted out from the calendar and cease to find a place in the glad procession of the year, the night of my conception. May it be barren. May it give life to nothing. Don't want it to hear any cry of joy because a child is born in it. May it be accursed so that ever trembling on the verge of dawn, the dawn may never break upon it. And finally, in verse number 10, he gives the sole reason for this tremendous imprecation on the night of his conception, that it was the night on which he entered on this life of misery and shame. That's why he's against it. Because, verse 10, it shut not the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. If that's not depression, I don't know what is. And then in verse 8, he says, let them curse it that curse the day who are ready to raise up their mourning. What's this mean? Notice in the NIV, some of you have calling up Leviathan or the dragon. Well, what we're really saying here is, as the sorcerers of his day built up superstitions as to what days were lucky and to what days were unlucky. You see, they believed there were great forces out there in the natural world which we are powerless to withstand. And certain men down through the years, and this is the oldest book in the Bible, right from the beginning of time, men have believed themselves to have acquired a secret and mysterious power over these lucky days or unlucky days. And the sorcerers, they believed they could affect the course of nature and give good fortune or bad fortune. And so into our lives has come astrological superstition, until even today, national journals publish the stars, which you and I have a sneak at now and again, to see how we're going to get on. And we shouldn't, because the Bible's totally against it. We don't know the future. And it's a good job that we don't know the future. Because if we did, we probably wouldn't want to live. God, in His mercy, shields what our future will be. But these fellows try to tell us, these ancient men, and even in our modern world. But because Job mentions these fellows, doesn't mean that he believed in them. He is simply saying here, well, if they want to curse a day and say it's a bad day, let them do that on the day I was born. Let them do that on the night of my conception. Let that be a bad time. Well, there it is, friends. Job's deepest heart about how he feels about himself. How do I feel about this passage personally? These first 10 verses, where he curses the day of his birth, on the night of his conception. Well, I feel quite simply that our friend Job had started to do what you and I should never do. He started looking. And he got taken up with himself. I wouldn't say altogether that he's overwhelmed with self-pity. That wouldn't be fair. But he feels so rotten and he feels so awful and he feels so far away from God and he feels such a disgusting person and he feels he's no good and no use. And he says, it'd been a good job if I had never been born. I felt like that a few times. Believe me, I have. But that's not the way you and I should think. And we have the full revelation of the Bible around this book of Job, which we can apply to his thinking. And God has revealed more truth to us than Job knew. Although Job later said, I know that my Redeemer liveth, at this particular point he hasn't got his eyes on him. And it's as simple as this, friends. I read a wee line somewhere. Your feet always follow your eyes. So watch what you put your eyes on. Peter sank when he got his eyes off the Lord. And if you and I start looking in and start looking on our failures and start looking on our inconsistencies, we'll be overwhelmed with it. We wish we'd never been born. Because I know worse things about myself than my worst enemies do. Boys could come to me tonight and say, Bingham, we know you. You hypocrite. And they may say something that I have done in the past. I could say to those fellas, come on up here, fellas, and I'll tell you even worse than that. But the language of the Christian is different. The language of the man of God, even in the Old Testament, who gets his eyes on the Lord and gets his eyes off himself, is different. We have old Abram when he went away off God's path and lied about his wife to the chief executive of Egypt, Pharaoh, and he was literally kicked out of the country because he was a liar. He went right back to the place where he got out of God's will, and he established an altar there to the Lord. And he got restored, and his language changed, and he became one of the greatest men of faith the world has ever seen. We have seen David in the 6 months that we looked at him get down until he's scrabbling on the gates of the city, pretending he's a madman and letting the saliva run down his beard, and you wouldn't have given two hoots. His eyes off himself is different. We have old Abram when he went away off God's path and lied about his wife to the chief executive of Egypt, Pharaoh, and he was literally kicked out of the country because he was a liar. He went right back to the place where he got out of God's will, and he established an altar there to the Lord. And he got restored, and his language changed, and he became one of the greatest men of faith the world has ever seen. We have seen David in the 6 months that we looked at him get down until he's scrabbling on the gates of the city, pretending he's a madman and letting the saliva run down his beard, and you wouldn't have given two hoots for him or tuppence either. You'd have said, look at David, that great man of God. Look, he's sunk. Yes, he had sunk all right. He had compromised and got out of God's will, and he was in a terrible way. Read the Psalms and you'll find out when David talks about it, you know. Sinking in deep mire, no standing, and sinking and feeling all was lost. You'll find this language in the language of Jeremiah 2 and others in the scripture that Job talks about in this chapter when you start to look in. But David says, this poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and delivered him out of all his troubles. And Stephen Alford told a story once on a radio program. I remember listening to it as a teenager at home in Newcastle. I'll never forget that morning on my uncle's radio. What a machine it was. And I remember Stephen telling about the young fellow walking along the beach. And he met the old salt, the old man who was the fisherman for so many years. And he said, sir, he said, that's a strange looking thing. He said, that kind of lobster pot thing. He said, there's a big hole in the top. Surely if you put that down and the fish go in, they'll see the hole and swim out again. What's the point of putting the thing into a big hole? Stupid. And the old fisherman said, you don't know much about fishing, son. That's what they always call me, son. He says, you don't know much about fishing, son. He said, because when we put that down, he said, the fish go through the hole all right. And he says, they go down into the net, but they got so taken up with the fact that they are stuck and caught in the bottom of the net, they thrash about for hours until we bring them up. And they just forget one sweet little thing. As they're thrashing away down there, they forget to look up. And how many a person is like that in life? The problems come in. You're overwhelmed. You look at the problems. You see the storm. And you forget to look up. Looking off unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. That's the strategy for the Christian race. We learned that in Hebrews 12 and 13. Get your eye on him. He's been down this road less traveled by. He has gone over the hurdles. He knows that it's a long road that has no turning. He understands he's been down the way before you. And because he's down there before you, look away off onto him. You just smile and say, well, I know the Prince of Peace. And carry on. Get your eye on him. Oh, it's simple, but it's profound. You know, I was thinking about this Job cursing the day of his birth and the night of his conception in these first 10 verses. And the Lord said, well, don't forget to tell him, Derek, about that fellow I met when I was here on earth. In John 9, it's recorded that there was a man blind from his birth, and there was a big controversy, you see. He'd been blind from the day of his birth. And they wanted to know whether it was his parents who had sinned or he who had sinned that he was born blind. And then they wanted to know that Jesus, who had come and given him sight, was a sinner. And that man gave a classic answer. He said, whether he be a sinner or no, I know not. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see. That was good theology for the theologians. Like Nicholson, when he arrived at Oxford or Cambridge University for a mission, and they were so much against him, they brought in some leading theologians to hold a mission at the same time to make this stupid wee Irish man look stupid, as they thought. And it is recorded that on the first night, the other missioner that had been brought along, an outstanding theologian, a very clever man with a string of degrees behind him, and the church is gradually being killed by degrees, he stood up and he gave his credentials and he said what his background was, his academic background, if I remember, and his theological background and his training, and he went on and on. And everybody wondered what the wee man from Bangor would say, because he was having a mission with the Christian Union. And Nicholson got up and said, well, my name is William Patterson Nicholson, and I am a sinner saved by grace. Is it any wonder that at the end of that mission, they carried old Nicholson shoulder high to the train? God blessed them so mightily, and many, many, many of those students found a Savior through his preaching. I'm not against academic work. I worked hard enough for my own degree, I'll tell you. That's how I lost all my hair. I'm not against it. But I am telling you this, that in these dark days, when so many people have so many things to say about the Christian faith, I love the attitude of this blind man who had been blind from birth. He doesn't curse the day he was born. No, he got a new birth. And he said, I'll tell you one thing. I'll tell you one thing, whether he's a sinner or no, I know not. But I was once blind and now I see. The man said to the little boy, just got saved, to try and trip him up, the very clever man, he said to him, how do you know you're saved, sonny? How do you know you're saved, little boy like you? He said, excuse me, sir, how do you know you're not saved? He says, I know rightly I'm not. Well, said the little boy, I know rightly I am. I think of Paul in Galatians chapter 1 and verse 15. It pleased God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me by his grace to reveal his son in me. Those words just thrilled me. First Paul talking about the day of his birth. He'd had the new birth. And it's like what I have on the front of these notes for you. Dr. Blair's great statement. Notice it. But I tell you one thing. Though I have known some curse the day of their first birth, I've never known anyone to curse the day of his second birth. And when you are born again, I've never heard a person curse the day he was born again. He thanks God for that day. He might curse the day he was born, because he's brought so much trouble in the world and feel like old Job. But when you get your eyes away from that, and get your eyes on your Redeemer, and don't let it overwhelm you. Although God lets us see him being overwhelmed. And sometimes we feel like that. The antidote to this state is the Christian antidote. Paul says, God separated me from the day of my birth. I love that, you know. He separated me from my mother's womb and called me by his grace. What for? To reveal his son in me. Galatians 1:15. Beautiful. Why am I alive? Well, from the day of my birth, God has separated me. Now, let's just take that for a wee minute. Can I go a little deeper? Paul was separated to God in three stages. Number one, at his birth, in God's mind. God, in his mind, had separated Paul from his birth. Paul didn't know it, but it was in God's mind. But in 1 Timothy 1, 15 and 16, we're told that Paul is separated to the gospel at conversion from Judaism. God separates him from Judaism through his conversion to the gospel. But then in 1 Timothy 1, 11 and 12, and in Acts 13 and 2, at his commission, God calls him from secular work to work for God in another sphere. He is separated particularly to a certain spiritual work. So that his separation came in three stages. And Christian, if you're feeling an utter despair tonight, get a look at your Lord. Get your eyes on him. Because there is a purpose in living. And yes, you might feel that the things you have done would cause you to curse the day you were born and the night you were conceived. But because he lives, you and I can face tomorrow. And because Christ lives, all fear is gone. Because I know that he holds the future. Life is worth the living. Why? Because he lives. Say amen. Lovely point that. And the point is that you are not aimless and purposeless, wandering around, wondering what it's all about. Your sins have been forgiven. And if Job had only thought about it a little deeper at this stage, he would have realized that those sacrifices that he had made in chapter 1 had indeed been speaking of his Redeemer in a shadow. And his sins had been forgiven. And that because those sins had been forgiven through those sacrifices speaking of Christ, there was a purpose in living. And because you have been forgiven, you're forgiven. Enjoy it. Don't endure it. Enjoy it. It's something to be enjoyed. Something to take you through the toughest day. Because you have the Lord Jesus. And because he lives within you, he'll carry you through. There's a purpose. I know that God spared me from illness last year to this point. And oh, I went and had an examination, an internal examination at the Royal last week. And the old surgeon said to me, well, he's not old, he's quite a nice looking fellow. He said to me, he says, you know, Derek, if I hadn't known what you had, he said, I'd have passed you as normal. Wasn't that nice? I'd have passed you as normal. Thank you, brother. But wasn't that lovely? To feel health coming back again. Spared for a purpose. Oh, life's worth living. Why are we spared? I lay with stood beside a bed where a fellow was lying the other day. The IRA had shot him all up and he was in a terrible way. And I was trying to say, Philly, you've been spared for a purpose. He said, I know that. I've been thinking about that ever since I came in here. Christ, why, if you hadn't got the Lord Jesus, there's no hope at all. If you hadn't got him, what's the point? But because we have him, everything has a point. Everything. But poor old Job's not thinking along that line. Back to verse 11. He now comes to, you know, it's beautiful poetry. You know, it's beautifully written. It seems as if in verse 11, he gets a little softer and quieter. Because he starts to tell us that he's longing for death. Verse 11. Why died I not from the womb, and why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly, and why did the knees prevent me, and why the breast that I should suck? For now I should have lain still and been quiet, I should have slept, then had I been at rest. Notice how he's not crying down catastrophe on the day of his birth now. His mind goes into another thought pattern, and he's beginning to long for death. You know, it almost seems as from verse 11 to verse 19 as if Job is in love with death. And from verse 11 to verse 13, he particularly longs for death. It attracts him. What attracts him about death? Well, it's restfulness. And he seems to turn from cursing to questioning. There's a progression of thought. He wishes he had not been conceived, or if conceived, that he had died in the womb. Or if he hadn't died in the womb, why had he wishes that he had not been born. Or if born, he wishes he had died at once. Or since he had grown to maturity, I wish I could die now. Poor Job. Wish I'd never been born. And when I was born, I wish I had died then. And because I have lived, because I've got to this place now. I wish I could die now. You know, death is a very important theme in this book. This book doesn't speak of the bliss of heaven or the awful terrors of hell. But there's never, ever a time in this book when Job thinks of death as a complete extinction, as Jehovah's Witnesses would teach us about annihilation. And if you're not, haven't got eternal life, you'll be annihilated. Jesus said, the broad way leads to destruction, and you can destroy something, and it's still alive. You can take a car and destroy it, and it's still sitting there. I saw a car destroyed, Takmona Estate this morning, absolutely destroyed, but still there. Not annihilated, destroyed. And the broad way leadeth to destruction. Doesn't mean annihilation. And Job now begins to list the kind of people who die. Note the 10 classes of people who die. Verse 14. Kings and counselors of the earth. Princes. Infants. The wicked. The weary. Prisoners. The small, the great, and the servant. Those of you taking notes, I'll just get those seven again. Or 10 classes of people. Kings, counselors, princes, infants, the wicked, the weary, prisoners, the small, the great, and the servant. And the meaning of that little statement in 14b, with kings and counselors of the earth, which built ruined or desolate places for themselves. That's a very difficult little phrase to understand. How could a king build a ruined place for himself? What does it mean? All kinds of attempts have been made to clarify this. And I would feel, reading it, that it simply means that just as princes can't take their wealth with them into eternity, when Howard Hughes died, the Methodist minister taking his funeral service said, the richest man probably in all the earth next to Paul Getty or men of that class, he said at Howard Hughes' funeral service, he brought nothing into the world and it certainly will take nothing out. Well, just as the princes of this world can't take their wealth into eternity with them, so the buildings that kings have that are now in ruins mock their worldly splendor since in death. Those kings are no different from a slave. There was a fellow in Lincoln in Arkansas who had a very interesting pastime. His wife had died and he was a very wealthy man. And he decided he'd raise a monument to his wife. His name was Davis. He was a self-made man. He was a farmer. And because his wife's people thought he'd married below himself, he said he wouldn't leave them a dime. He was very absolute miser. Left nothing to his in-laws, or outlaws as some people call them. And he erected a rather elaborate statue to his wife. He made a love seat and he put himself at one end and his wife at the other in stone. People used to say, that's beautiful. And he liked people saying that, so he went into the monument erecting business and he pulled that one down and he built another one of himself kneeling down with a wreath at his wife's grave. People thought that was beautiful. So he was so impressed with that, he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll prepare my own grave. And he prepared his own grave and made a statue of his wife, kneeling with a wreath, at his graveside, even though he hadn't died yet. And because he wanted to impress people with the fact that she had died, he put wings on her back. And people said, now look here, Mr. Davis, and this is from Charles Swindoll's essay in his famous little book, Home, Where Life Makes Up Its Mind. He said, what's this town ever done for me? Whenever people said, would you not, Mr. Davis, give us a new swimming pool or perhaps help with a hospital? I don't owe this town nothing, he is said to have said. And he died at 92 years of age, a rather grim-faced resident of the poorhouse. And he spent $250,000 on those monuments. And if you were to go to Lincoln in Kansas, you would see them sinking slowly into the old Kansas soil, victims of time and neglect and perhaps vandalism. And they'll soon all be gone. Very few people attended Mr. Davis's funeral. Only one person seemed genuinely moved by any sense of personal loss. He was a man called Horace England. He was the tombstone salesman. And we laugh. He was very sorry to see Mr. Davis go. We laugh. And yet there are people sitting in this meeting tonight reading those tremendous words of Job's. Where kings and counselors of the earth go into death, building desolate places for themselves. What a phrase. Building monuments in life that crumble into Mediterranean rubble. I've been to Herod's palaces, and they're pathetic looking now. Weren't so pathetic when he built them. Princes, verse 15, that had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Where's it all now? It's gone. There are some of you sitting here tonight, and you're building a monument or two. Some of you have a monument, and you're building it to fortune. Fortune which says, get rich. And you're going to get rich. And that monument you build is crazy. It's all going to pass away. Some of you building a monument to fame. You want to be famous. And into that monument is written that little word, be famous. A monument to fame. And you know what to do with the George Best of this world? Is it any wonder George took his sister one day on his knee, had a party after a match in Windsor Park, and I quote her, for she told me. He said, look everybody, my sister is saved. And she has more than all the rest of us combined. Be famous. Be saved, friend. Have God's salvation. And it's better than all the monuments of earth. Some of you building a monument to pleasure. And that's the big monument of the moment. It's etched into it in marble. And the marble of the monument of pleasure. In other words, indulge yourself. If it tastes good, taste it. And if it feels good, then do it. I remember once going round a little cemetery in my hometown at Newcastle, a little cemetery called Tully Brannigan. And I noted down all the graves. And there were captains of schooners, and there were surgeons on schooners, and there were privates, or rather just ordinary ratings in the Navy buried there. And there were Methodist ministers buried there, and Catholic priests buried there, and Church of Ireland archdeacon buried there. And little infants, 2 months old, buried there. And there was a member for West Cavan who raised his voice in the House of Commons there. Died many years ago when Ireland was, the whole of Ireland was in the Union. And there were little children there, and there were old men there, and there were fellows who had been at Gallipoli. There's one fellow lies there, fought with Garibaldi in Italy. There's men who were killed, airmen. And I just walked around that, and I came out of that graveyard that day. I was doing a little article for the newspaper. When as a child the words came to me, I laughed and wept. Time crept. And when as a youth I grew more bold, time strolled. And when I became a full-grown man, time ran. And soon I shall find as I journey on, time gone. Wilt thou, O Christ, have saved me then? Amen. So be it. You saved tonight. You ready to go where kings and counselors go? Notice verse 16. Or as an hidden untimely birth I had not been, as infants which never saw light, little stillborn children in death. Even the wicked cease from troubling people when they die. Don't want to be morbid, but I had a friend used to know well, and he was a gravedigger. I said, tell me, Mr. Bryans, do you never get scared working up there at night? He was always in the graveyard. You know, none of us like to walk through graveyards in the middle of the night, never talk about the daytime. I said, you know, you're working away, that's a lot of your work. Do you never get frightened? He says, Derek, the dead can't do you any harm. The living that cause the bother. Well, I thought, I'm sorry I asked. But you know, there was a man who was just saying exactly what Job was saying. The wicked don't trouble anybody when they're dead. The wicked cease from troubling. And oh, how this verse seems to wring his heart, the weary be at rest. Ah, how different. When you and I stand here tonight as a Christian, Christians, if we know the Lord, what do we say? We say, for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. We have it best both ways. If I live here tomorrow, serve the Lord for another day. And if I die, it's a whole eternity to serve the Lord. Hallelujah. Even in the face of death. But if you're not saved, what hope have you? For death will take you to a lost eternity. Oh friend, are you ready to go where kings and little stillborn children go? Where even the servant no longer has to serve his master. Notice verse 18, the prisoners rest together and they hear not the voice of the oppressor. The small and the great are there and the servant is free from his master when he dies. And Job here is giving seven reasons why he laments his manhood from verse 14 to verse 19. He's lamenting his manhood because life is a misery for him, firstly. Secondly, because he's bitter in his soul. Thirdly, because he feels that death is better than life. Fourthly, because he's in desperation. Fifthly, because he feels the grave would be a relief to end it all. And lastly, because he feels that life is so hedged in. As we look at these tremendous verses, let's just see verse 20. Wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul. You know, Job is even striking deeper into the problem by asking, why should it happen at all? Why? Wherefore is light given to him that's in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul? Why should the result of God's good gift of life be that those who have it wish to be rid of it? He's very depressed. Notice verse 21 and verse 22. He's actually longing for death, but it cometh not, and digging for it more than for hid treasure. Death would be an absolute treasure to him in the state he's in. Which rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave. It is as when a friend of mine was buried today, and my wife was talking about him. He's been through a lot of pain recently. And you know, she was just saying about how that it was probably better for him that the Lord took him home. I said, you're just saying what we're on tonight. Death can be a mercy. And I have known that experience. Watching someone dying of cancer, screaming with pain for 6 months. In a sense, I longed that death would come to take them away. And I don't think there's anything wrong in what Job is saying here, because he's so ill and he's so sick. Death would be a relief. It would be a mercy. Ah, but God didn't allow him to die. And it's exactly what Johnny Erickson said when she broke her neck and can't move anything from her neck down. For Johnny said, I asked God, please God, let me die. Teach me, please. Teach me to die. Let me die. And God said, no. And Johnny said, well, all right, Lord, if you won't let me die, then teach me how to live. Teach me how to live. Yes, Job is saying it would be a relief, but God wouldn't let it. Because his misery and his illness, God was using it and is going to teach us tremendous lessons through these next few months of teaching from this book. And God didn't let the relief of death come, even though he was desperate. And in verse number 23, you know, why is light given to a man whose way is hid and to whom God has hedged in? As far as Job was concerned, he couldn't see beyond his nose. Didn't know where he was going. His way was hid. And so is yours and so is mine. Is your way not hid tonight and my way not hid? Sure is. I don't know about the future. And I feel maybe as a Christian tonight, and you do listening to me on tape or in this meeting, you say, come on, Derek, my life is hedged in. Well, that's what Job says. He said, why does he give light to a man who can't see the future and God is hedged in? Well, wasn't that the very thing that Job had said, or Satan had said about Job? He said, look, God, he said, Jehovah, you've got that fella hedged in. Take the hedge away and he'll curse you. Even Satan could see the hedge that God had put around Job as protecting him. And tonight you may feel very restricted, Christian, and feel there's not much future for you and your circumstances are very restricted. But you're restricted. affliction is allowed by God. Why? It's intended by God to hem you in for a purpose. It's protecting you from all sorts of crazy things you would do if God let you loose in a certain place. So he hedges you in. He doesn't let you do it. Tremendous. His life seems to be all in a muddle, and he can't see no design to it, and no aim, and there's no clear way, and no noble intention, and no exit. And he's just saying from verse 24 to verse number 26, my sighing cometh before I eat, my roarings are poured out like the waters. For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I wonder, was that losing favor with God, he felt. I have a feeling that that's perhaps what he meant. The thing I greatly feared, I seem to have lost favor with God. But he hadn't lost favor with God at all. God was using the restriction of his circumstance to bring him to great blessing. And you're sitting in your restricted circumstance tonight, then maybe you're saying like Job, oh, the thing I fear has come. The heavens are as brass. God won't answer my prayers. I can't get out of this problem. There's no answer to it. It's endless. It goes on and on and on. How do you know that you're not being used as a spectacle? And there's some fella in your circumstances in Northern Ireland tonight, and he's cursing God to his face, high and low. And Satan's saying, ah, there you are, God. And God says, you see that girl over there in the Royal Victoria, or that fella there at Queen's, or that girl at Strand, or that housewife at home, or that man in business, look at the problems he's got, the very same as that other fellow over there, perhaps. And what's he doing? He's blessing God. And he's being exactly like Job. Yes, he moans sometimes about how life is a misery and how he wishes sometimes death would come to take him out of it. But he doesn't curse God. He blesses God. Maybe you're like Job in these last three verses. When he says, as I put it in the notes, in utter despair, he's really saying, I cannot relax, I cannot settle, I cannot rest, and agitation keeps coming back. Is that how you feel? Well, let's turn our eyes away off into a time of worship just now as we close.